things off, John Musty is going to talk about Jim's early years up till about, well, not up to about 21, isn't it, John? Up to 21, because he was around during that period and knows Jim very well from those days. And he's going to be telling us some very interesting things which formed the personality that we knew about Jim. So this is John.
Right, well, thank you all very much for coming on such a glorious day. I can well imagine Jim saying, I don't know what you're doing here on a day like this, you should go for the world
tonight. Can't be saying James, isn't it?
Yeah, heard Buddy Holly, you know, I imagine that by now Jim will have probably tracked him down where he is, and I've got the real story on that paintbrush. And after that, I can imagine he's gone off to find the pilot. I'm happy what he's got. Jim, my brother, was born in 1940 in Victoria Hospital in Blackpool. Our parents were married in 1939. And by the time Jim was born, time had cleared off to do his bit in World War II. At the outset of the war, actually, he was too old to be enlisted in the first plane. And he reckoned the best thing to do to make sure he got a good job would be to volunteer on the call us. So he lied about his age and talked to the RAF. Can you spot a pattern here? As a baby, Jim's probably his most notable characteristic of what mother said was his smile. He just had that amazing smile. Everywhere people said, what a lovely, lovely child he is. At that time, the father away, in fact, Jim was six before he had Christmas with his father. The father away, mother was going back to teaching. At the weekends, she had to go and run the father's golf pro shop, and people were trying to scrape a few balls together to keep that business going. She was doing fire watch and hours. Very busy, and she enlisted the help of a lady who'd been an elderly spinster who'd been born down in Manchester. So she was surrounded by these two people. This elderly lady, probably the nicest thing for her in her life, and she really loved her. So he grew up surrounded by female adulation. I think this gave him a few points towards the man. Now, having an airline family and this other thing on the sky above, he was interested in airplanes, pop stars, and also, when he was very young, one of the things he enjoyed most, was travelling from Fleetwood to North End on the Wyre Ferry, which was, it was actually still going when I was around. It was a paddle steamer, and you sat in the stern of this thing and looked forward, and there you would see this huge boiler and as many copper pipes as I can ever remember. They're all gleaming and shining. It had two huge great big cylinders thumping away and a grimy stove there, and it was just fascinating. And it was the noise and the smell of steam and that car. I loved it. Mother said that an awful lot of three-year-olds or people of his age on the ferry would have just been frightened of that Jim loved it. So did I. And I think something was ignoring that. By 1943, it was getting pretty tough, and mother was getting very tired. So she went down to Birmingham with Jim to work in her father's school. Now, grandfather was a remarkable man. He was self-taught, and he devoted himself to learning off his own account. And it's pretty much like Jim in many ways. Jim was always keen to get to know more stuff. Grandfather was the same. Taught himself everything, became a head teacher, was a very, very practical man. He built musical instruments, he was a singer, a great man. And he picked up straight away what Jim had. And he nurtured him a lot for the next 4 or 5 years until the war ended and then came home. But that was a very, very saving point, I think, in Jim's growing up. Then he went back to Fleetwood, and it's an interesting issue. New babies, you sort of handle them, you know, like they're trying out to toddle them or something like that. You just got to be really careful with them. When I arrived, when Jim was 8, mother just handed him back to Jim in the back of the car and said, "Here, you look after it." So I was taken back from the hospital to home with my elder brother looking after him. And he did that, right the way through from then on. And I think that was very, very good of mother to actually delegate that responsibility to him, because he really kept it all his life. He was an adventurer. Mother said when he was 3, she caught him one day, probably barely 2 and a half, and he managed to drag a stool up to the front door and climb up on it, and he was busy tampering with the door lock, trying to get out. That apparently was very typical of him. He had this angelic smile that everybody loved as a baby, but she said underneath there was an awful lot going on, and she said he was a real help. And so that's another reason why she went back up to Birmingham, to get more people around to keep an eye on him and watch him work. Of course, the father came around and began to settle down a bit. One day, he would have been about 10, I suppose. Everything was an adventure to Jim. He was out trespassing, as he did, and he fell into a slurry pit. Well, the father was a typical Lancashire. I did meet him in later life, not a pleasant chap. And he had the joy of fishing Jim out of this slurry pit. Not nice. There's Jim in his Sunday suit, as it happened at the time. So the farmer just took him over, got the hose by the back, you stand there, lad, and hosed him down. And then he took him back to mum, dripping. That was sorry to think, but that sort of thing happened a lot. I can remember it. Mother was forever having to really tackle it. You know, I can remember visions of her now, chasing up the stairs behind him with a bicycle, raining blows on his backside. So often, he really was, as she said, a hellraiser, and very difficult to keep an eye on. But that's because Jim was an original person, an original thinker. He wanted to get out and do things his own way. And he was very keen on just promoting his own interests. We moved to Lillington Town when I was 11. No, Jim was 11. Dad got a job at the Royal Liverpool Golf Club, and he moved there. And Jim, by that stage, went to grammar school, because he passed his 11 plus. He was quite bright. And his teenage years, I remember, he just devoted to his strip watches, he built radios, he had steam engines, repairing steam engines, there were balsa wood models, construction kits, there was just all sorts of stuff going on in his bedroom. If I was ever allowed in there, it was wonderful to go in there. I'd never go out on my own, just give me hell if I did. But there was so much going on there, and where did the knowledge come from? Dad didn't know about this stuff. Dad wouldn't know how to build a valve radio, but Jim did. He learnt it all. Very, very keen to acquire knowledge. He used to look after me in strange ways. He gave me his old Ian Allen train spotting books. I don't think one of those. But he said, they're not good back on. He said, they put the photographs in the wrong place. So he said, I've changed them now, but I'll put them in there for you. That's how it should be. And it's typical, because Jim always wanted to improve things. He could never leave well alone. I would say, that's going fine, let's go out and play with it. No, we're going to do this too. Always, always improving things. Later on, he went to Manchester University and studied metallurgy. That actually gave him a very interesting insight into what came out of his life. He was a very wide circle of friends, as you see today. Amazing. And eventually, these included girls. And I remember being given strict instructions to be respectful to all of them and not to tease them. Later on, he was allowed to entertain young ladies. And it must have really cracked the style. Usually, when I was like 11 or 12, then I used to come home from Scouts or something like that, go bursting into the house to see what was on television, and there they were. But he dealt with this surprisingly patiently in spite of that. And I remember Jim didn't harbour grudges, but he had a good memory. And 8 years later, I was sat down in the lounge with my first girlfriend, hoping to get a bit of progress on the way. And he came bouncing in through the door of the lounge. Well, I won't tell you what he said. They put things back, I'm quite a good one. Had an experience. Jim passed his driving test within weeks of his 17th birthday. Driving test, yes. And then, straight away, he had to have a car. It was just like that. So we still had the receipt we found the day. £15 changed hands. He bought this 1930 Austin 7 called the Yellow Peril. You see pictures of it at the Aero Club. And he actually drove that thing to Manchester, probably 2 or 3 times a week to university, because we like being in lodgings there. I have to think now, having got something like that myself, those cold days, an old thing like that, but this is Jim, he was determined to get it done and get through it. The car, of course, it worked, but not well enough for Jim. Yeah, that was no good. It had to be better, and he started finding out many people around the area who had cars like this. And for Jim, if he needed an engine or a gearbox, very often he came with a whole car. And I can remember one time our drive had three Austin 7s in it in various stages of disarray. And there were more on the way until Mother said, no, sorry, this has got to stop. So from then on, it was just bits and pieces that came in, but they did. And by the time he got rid of the peril, it had about three engines, four gearboxes, I don't know. But also by the time he got rid of the peril, he rebuilt it. And it went to a guy in Blackpool, and it is now still running today. So Jim's first restoration project, first car he ever owned, you'll go. That's the something about it. At that time, he was very interested in music. At college, he'd always liked jazz, particularly traditional jazz. The early records in our house had Buck Clayton and Ben Goodman. And he had a harmonica he bought in Germany, and he used to drive his mad with that. And he had a cornet as well that was given by an uncle. Now, we didn't hear him play that much about it, but I understand he was in a jazz band when he was at college. Can you make points about what happened at university? I don't know, but he did play that. And for example, long before the Beatles had made it, Hammond was famous. Jim had been going there. He, by now, had tremendous mechanical expertise, stuff he'd learnt himself, and people found that they wanted to borrow those skills. And this helped him make a lot of friends in new areas very quickly. People here today, I know, will remember his go-karting days. And Jim was very keen on go-karting, and that was a big phase in his life. Typically, he couldn't afford to buy a faster kart, so he got right on build one, having first built a trailer to learn how to weld. And then having built this faster kart, he thought, should have hydraulic brakes on it. Why not then? So his hydraulic brakes on it. Jim, always improving, and stripping the engine well. But yeah, I remember, it was a wonderful occasion. He had the thing outside the back door of the house, there, and it just done a run around the front garden, and the engine wouldn't stop, and it suddenly started screaming. And he started running on the pressure, and he tried to stop it, and it wouldn't stop. So he got right, banged it into fourth gear, put his foot on the brake, dropped his head, woof, straight through the garage door. So then, you know, the younger brother, 8 years younger, was suddenly commandeered into the act again, and we got them fixed before Dad came home. Yeah. It's amazing how, even though there was such an age difference between us, we did work really quite well together. Then he bought the MGA when he was at university. He just finished, and he put himself seriously into hock, and he had this magnificent MGA. It really was beautiful. It was very old then. For me, at 14 years old, a drive in that car was an absolute thrill. Because I remember going back to the front at one time, doing 50 miles an hour, and there was a gap, and I swear there was no more than an inch and a half either side, straight through without even thinking about it. He was good. He really was. Tremendous skills like that. But of course, here we are, Jim's now getting up towards 21. Different things happen. We've done a fair amount of research into girls in the local area. fair amount of work, really, and he noticed a new girl that moved in quite quickly, actually. He noticed Gabe moved into the scene before I did. And one girl, Gabe, caught his eye. So before anybody else put Snapper up, he made his move. And he started off by courting a mother with flowers and chocolates. And he took her father off to play golf. So when he started getting around to serious business, he'd already paid the way. He was very well organized. But I think that was actually, I remember Father saying, when we went to his farewell do, and he said, one of the greatest moments in my life, I remember, he said, was when I heard somebody saying, I do, by my side. And I think possibly Jim could say that. Now, although he notified scholarship at the ATC, he never actually followed it through. I don't know why, but that was it. But he pushed me in to join the University Air Squadron. And it actually worked out quite well, because when he went to fly and learnt at Oxford, he got his pilot's license, and he came down to Blackpool where I was at the time. By then, I'd been in the University Air Squadron, and I'd got about 40 hours on chipmunks. So he said, well, let's take the chipmunk down to Squires Gate. So we went along and spoke to the people there. Of course,
Jim had a PPL, fine.
Was he current on type?
No. Was I current on type? Yes. So we blanked our way into it, and we went off and we took this chipmunk out of the thing. This chipmunk came to us spitfire. And it was one of the nicest things I ever done. We went out over the channel in this chipmunk, and we practiced rolling and braking, and we dived all the shipping, and we strafed the beaches through it. Lovely for us to get a chance to do it. Wonderful. The memories that we go through. There were lots and lots of other scrapes that we went through, he got through, but you'll hear an awful lot about that later on. And I did probably hear not too much from me. So I look forward to hopefully trying to meet as many of you with that as I can later on and enjoy the rest of you. Same thing.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much, John. Fantastic. Listening to John's summary of Jim's early days, I'm reminded of a fictional character that used to be sort of part of my childhood, and the older people here probably remember. Just William, William Brown, the Richmond Crompton character. I think Jim sort of saw himself in that vein as well, because Gay told me that during their early time together, they went to a fancy dress party, and I can just see Jim now in the character he adopted, which was Just William. And Gay went as Violet Elizabeth Bott. Hopefully he didn't scream through until he finished. As John was saying, when Jim decided that Gay was the one for him, he used an engineer's precision to make sure that she would become his wife. Not only did he woo Gay, but he also wooed mother and father, and just to make sure that it really worked properly. Golf became the connection between the families. Now, another possible suitor for Gay at that time was an up-and-coming rock star whose name was Michael Philip Jagger, who actually was casting adoring eyes on her. But Gay, I think you made the right choice. An airline pilot trumps a rock star. So the happy couple were married in Sedans near Blackpool on the 26th of March, 1965. Which happens to be the 31st anniversary of the introduction of the driving test to Great Britain. Now, that may sound like a somewhat random fact, but when I asked Gay where the newlyweds went for their honeymoon, she said to me, well, we didn't really go anywhere. Jim taught me to drive instead. So, bit by bit, we're getting a picture of Jim as a thoroughly practical, solid, sensible person who got his priorities right. But that only tells half of the story. When I asked Perry for some of his boyhood memories of Dad, he told me how at one stage he had to get his school homework signed off by one of his parents. So Jim did the honours using the nom de plume Famous Father. Requested by the school to take things more seriously, Jim signed the next assignment, Fred Flintstone. Perry then asked Mum to sign it off instead, so Gay did. She signed it Wilbur Flintstone. So, warming to his role of teasing the teachers, Jim felt compelled to reply to a school letter telling parents that there were several cases of nits. Don't you think, he wrote, that in these austere times, several cases of nits are extravagant? Surely one case is sufficient. Now, Perry was born on August the 17th, 1973, nearly 3 years after Sam, who was Jim and Gay's first child, born in 1970 on October the 2nd, which makes her a Libra. Jim, I think we could say, adapted well to fatherhood. Given all that we heard from John, it's probably no surprise that Jim used to tie a sledge to the back of his car and tow the children around during snowy winters. Apparently somewhat to the neighbour's consternation. He was actually no great fan of Christmas, though, and spent long spells during the festive period in the garage, hammering away at whatever project was on his workbench. In fact, on one occasion, asked where her father was, the young and innocent Sam said, "He's in the bloody L garage," which was what she thought it was called. The two most popular words which flew through the portals were indeed bloody L. And Gay actually told me that the garage became a focal point of Jim's life. And she said, I was always popping down to the shops to get milk, since there was a constant stream of middle-aged airmen, mechanics, and car enthusiasts turning up who needed tea to keep them going. Gay's mother had commented about Jim's job as a pilot. He's always mucking about. He's out all odd hours. He needs a nice 9-to-5 job. But I think it's pretty clear that a 9-to-5 job would not have suited Jim at all. Now, as we heard from John, Jim's degree was in metallurgy, and that was where his early career took him, I think. But the flying side of things began in 1967, around the age of 27. He trained at Oxford, at the Oxford Air Training School, and was sponsored jointly by BEA and the OAC, which were still individual organisations at the time. With the course completed, Jim joined BEA as a first officer on the Hawker Siddeley, which was formerly the De Havilland Trident, which was the first aircraft in commercial service which had autoland. He was on the type for 7 years before spending a similar period on the Lockheed TriStar, which was a new type for BEA. Initially, Jim flew European routes on the TriStar, but then when the OAC and BEA got together and formed British Airways, he flew both long-haul and short-haul. His command came on the BAC 111, and it was on this aircraft that he achieved considerable distinction on a takeoff from Basel in Switzerland, Italy, and France, I think. Basel, the three countries, quite funny airport. Anyway, Golf Alpha Victor Mike Tango had a full payload and it burst a tyre on rotation. And he'd already gone past V1, which is the speed at which the plane can safely stop. So he nursed the aircraft into the sky with one engine failed due to ingestion of tyre debris. He managed to nurse it all around the mountains surrounding Basel and eventually made a safe landing. Now, when other pilots tried the same procedure and the same conditions in the simulator, most of them had a bad outcome. So Jim is able to add aviation hero to his other list of achievements. Now, finally, he went on to the A320 family of aircraft, which is where he remained. He remained with that fleet until his retirement, which was in 1995, at the age of 55. Now, I met Jim a couple of years earlier when I was working at Whitehaven in operations in 1992. Now, Jim was always polite, he was always patient, just asked for his plane out, never made a fuss, never made a drama. And then, in April 1993, I was over in Vienna doing a mayonnaise commercial for Austrian television. And on conclusion of the shoot, the woman who was playing my girlfriend and I caught the BA flight back to Heathrow. Now, we were the last two passengers on, and as I walked down the jetway, I caught a rear three-quarter view of the captain on the flight deck. And I thought to myself, why, that looks just like Jim Musty. But then I said, no, it can't be Jim Musty, because he just flies a chipmunk at Whitehaven. So I asked the cabin crew gentleman, and I said to him, is the captain Jim Musty? And he replied, I'm afraid so. So I asked if he'd be kind enough to let me know that James from flight operations of Whitehaven was in seat 1C and pass on my best wishes. Now, within a minute, I was sitting in the jump seat with my girlfriend next to me. Jim had really insisted that my girlfriend came onto the flight deck for takeoff as well. And for the first and only time, I started the engines on an A320. Now, the point is that I've flown with lots of pilots in my job who simply cannot wait to tell people that they fly jets. They tell them that before they even tell their name. But Jim wasn't like that at all. Jim was completely unassuming, at Whitehaven, just one of the lads. And indeed, when Perry married Jo in 2011, Jim actually wasn't a fan of making a fuss about anything, as we all know. And Perry and Jo had to actually change their original plans for the wedding because they were a bit worried that Jim either might not turn up or might sort of stay there just for the ceremony and then get back to his garage to the airplane or something. So they actually got married in Concord, which was parked at Brooklands. And as soon as Jim heard that the marriage was going to take place in Concord, he perked up hugely, apparently. And definitely, he was going to be there. Even better than that, Jim was assigned to drive the happy couple on the day in his Dodge. So he was very pleased about that. And the reception was a lovely do at White Waltham. The culinary highlight being that most delicious of celebratory meats, a hog roast. There was absolutely loads, and Jim gave me instructions to make sure that all the lads, that is the ground crew at White Waltham, get plenty. And that was the thing about Jim. He included everybody. There were never any exclusions. And I can't tell you how much crackle I had that night. It was absolutely wonderful. And I think that was the first time I met Gay and Sam. Jim called me over and said to me, James, this is my wife, Gay. Gay, this is James. He's going to be doing my funeral. And that's Jim, practical to the team. I met Perry in the previous decade when he was learning to fly at White Waltham. And I remember Jim coming to Ops one day, and while Perry was up being taught by Terry Curry. Anything you need, Jim? I asked him. No, I'm just waiting for that rat to land, he replied with a great big grin on his face. I said, what did you come and call Perry a rat? He's lovely. He's a rat, he said, the grin even bigger. But I know he was immensely proud of his family, thrilled that Perry is a professional pilot for BA and just about to start training on the Boeing Dreamliner. So make sure you know where the fire extinguishers are. At Jim's request, there are no prayers or hymns today, but this is a nice relaxing piece by quite a famous singer to let your minds wander just while you think.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song. Bonds of earth and dance the sky on laughter silvered wings,
sunward I climbed and joined the tumbling murk of sun-split clouds, and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless falls of air. Up the long delirious burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent lifting mind I've trod the high untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God.
Jim said to me some years back, they told me I had 6 months to live, but that was a couple of years ago and I'm still here. To say that he bore his condition with dignity doesn't begin to describe how Jim spent the final years of his life. He was still flying this year. I remember him requesting a member of ground crew to assist him with fueling the Cessna back in the summer. Jim did whatever he could, as always in life, to encourage other males to get checked for prostate. Gay tells me when the nurses came round to help with Jim in the later stages of his illness, they said that most houses that they went to were really subdued, a bit depressed, but it was always like a party at Jim and Gay's place. There was a constant stream of visitors and well-wishers, and when the engineers came round to fit a stair lift to make it easier for him to get to the top of the house, he managed to persuade them to tweak it so that it went faster. That shames the boy Jim right to the very end. And the same apparently with the mobility scooter. If it moved, there was a way to make it go faster. Jim was pretty diligent in the last few years. He sorted out all the finances and the possessions so that it was easier for Gay when he was no longer around. There was no diminishing of the slightly sardonic humour. When Gay accompanied Jim to hospital not 4 weeks ago, he said to her, "Thanks for bringing me in, little love. You can bugger off now." Jim always said that he would hang on until Lily, his beloved granddaughter, took her first steps, and she did duly oblige just a day or two before the end. In the last few weeks, Gay has received over 100 cards and letters of condolences, which is fantastic. I'd like to read just one of those from Richard Poe, who's an ex-BA pilot, and he's the chairman of the Maidenhead Heritage Centre. He sent us this to Sam, actually. "Dear Sam, what a lovely man your dad was, never complaining despite his long battle with illness. He was a great supporter of Maidenhead Heritage Centre and often helped with a hangar tour, which takes place at the end of the lecture series. His knowledge of aircraft was encyclopedic, much better than mine, and so I was always pleased to have him along. And Sam's asked me to say as well, there was never a dull moment when Dad was around. He was a really good father, always there to support us, and I spoke to him every single day. And also in the poem, High Flight, Sam made a very good point, the line, 'and done 100 things you had not dreamed of.' Well, that was Jim. He did hundreds of things that none of us have dreamed of. Planes and boats and trains, not to mention cars. He flew the Sea Fury, the Spitfire, the Meteor, the Hunter, the Jet Provost. He restored back to flying condition an Oster, a Chipmunk, a Turbulent, the Flying Flea. And there is really so much to say. We just simply don't have time to touch on everything. So please, please come back to the airfield chat to Gay and to Joe and to John and Sam, and of course, I said Gay already, anyway, yeah, sorry, this is twice today, and Joe, who are the immediate family. Jim typically told Gay that he wasn't bothered what she did with him after he died. "You can dump me in a wheelie bit for all I care." But Jim, a man who took care of others, thought of others, loved his family, and was full of pride, was a hero pilot, gave far more than he ever took, made us all laugh, dumped in a wheelie bin. Sorry, Jim, that'll be the day.
Oh, yeah.